Hello and welcome to this Australian Family Physician podcast. I'm your host, Professor Steve Margolis, and today we welcome Associate Professor Sanjeeva Vijayasinha from the Department of General Practice at Monash University, Victoria, to the microphone to talk about the common male reproductive problems. More detailed information can be found in the article, The Male Reproductive System, an Overview of Common Problems, in the May 2013 edition of AFP, co-authored with Professor Leon Pitterman and Dr. Catherine Kirby, both also at Monash University. Professor, thanks very much for your time and talking to AFP Audio.
Thanks for inviting me, and I'm very happy to be able to answer any questions and clarify any points.
Thank you. Perhaps we can start with why you consider this to be an important problem for general practitioners.
When one considers the diseases or the problems associated with the male reproductive system, one finds that these are not identified as often as they can be in general practice. And there are several reasons for this. Very often, the patient has a problem or some condition, but does not present to see his GP, either because the symptoms are evident, but he's embarrassed to talk about them. For example, swelling of the testes, or loss of libido, or even erection problems. The other reason for patients not coming is that they don't have any obvious symptoms, you know, like the patient who's got hypertension or diabetes or early prostate cancer, which cause no symptoms. And unless the patient is motivated to come for a checkup, even if they have no symptoms, they don't present until the diseases are well established. Another reason is that we as doctors or as general practitioners don't routinely ask for symptoms when taking a history, symptoms of sexual disease. I had a patient I referred to a diabetes specialist recently after I diagnosed him to be having diabetes after a glucose tolerance test. And when he came back, I asked him, as usual, for feedback about his consultation with the specialist. And he said, "Doctor, he asked me a lot of questions, including whether I had any erectile problems." And I was surprised by that. I said, "No, that's very important, because erection difficulty could be one of the early symptoms of heart disease. And a lot of patients don't know that."
Thank you for that. During this podcast, we'll talk about a few different individual conditions, but let's talk first about erectile dysfunction, which is increasingly talked about in the general media. Perhaps you'd like to walk us through.
With erectile dysfunction, I think the best definition is an inability to have or to maintain an erection that's hard enough for satisfactory sexual intercourse. In the past, we used to talk about impotence, and some of the older studies done on this subject refer to impotence. Unfortunately, impotence implies a lack of potency or power, and it's easier, it's more acceptable for a man to say he's got erectile dysfunction rather than to say I'm impotent. So the definition, I think, is a very good one. And when you asked me how common it was, there's a quotation that I often use when I talk about this subject from Chris McMahon from the Australian Center for Sexual Health, who said it's the most untreated, treatable medical disorder in Australia. This was a few years ago. There's a study done in Perth in 1999 which said only 11% of men with erectile dysfunction sought help from their doctors. And the original study on this subject, when it was called impotence, is from the Massachusetts male study, which was done about 20 years ago. And they interviewed 1,200 men in Massachusetts about erection problems, and very interestingly found that, as a rough estimate, about 40% of men in their 40s, going up to 70% of men in their 70s, did admit to some form of erectile difficulty. So it is a common problem. Fortunately, thanks to the drug companies marketing medications for this condition, it's come out more in the open, and I've had patients, as I think a lot of GPs have had, patients coming and admitting to having erectile dysfunction and asking us for medications for it. So it is common. I think that is a very good question you asked. Is it a symptom or a disease? Erectile dysfunction is a symptom. And in the majority of men, it is a symptom of cerebrocardiovascular disease. There's a great slide that I borrowed from somebody else and use in my lectures, which shows the diameter of the penile vessels, the coronary arteries, and the cerebral arteries. The penile arteries are, say, 1 to 2 millimeters in diameter. Coronary arteries are 3 to 4 millimeters in diameter. And the cerebral arteries are a little larger. And narrowing of the arteries is a generalized phenomenon. It occurs because we've got cerebrocardiovascular disease, arteriosclerosis, hypertension, too much of cholesterol, smoking. And what is significant is that this process affects the smaller blood vessels first. So the manifestation of cerebrocardiovascular disease hits the penile arteries initially. So a man who doesn't have enough blood flowing to his penis to give him an erection that's adequate for sexual intercourse, that doesn't give him a hard enough erection, could be, in many cases, manifesting the early signs of arteriosclerosis. In fact, there's a chap called Jeffrey Hackett, a sexual health physician in the UK, and he wrote a letter to the British Medical Journal in which he said that somebody who's got erectile dysfunction is someone who's got twice the risk of heart disease as a person without erectile dysfunction. He qualifies erectile dysfunction as a symptom of vascular disease in the smaller arteries. And this was in 2008, where he wrote to the BMJ, and that's available online if anyone wants to Google it. But he said erectile dysfunction is not a lifestyle issue. It's a predictor of serious cardiovascular problems. Best managed, I say the best thing to do is if a patient comes to you as a GP with a complaint of erectile dysfunction, ask about cardiovascular risk factors and start treating them. And if he so desires, you can give him medications to help with the erectile dysfunction. If a patient who's got the risk factors of cardiovascular disease is seen by you, ask about erectile dysfunction. As my endocrinologist colleague asked my patient, don't feel shy to ask about erectile dysfunction. Say this is a routine question. We usually ask patients who've got, high blood pressure or diabetes or elevated blood sugar, how are your erections? Are they as strong as they were before? I think that's a very practical way of dealing with the problem of erectile dysfunction.
Thank you for that. That's a very comprehensive discussion, a very important topic. Now let's consider premature ejaculation, which is another relatively well-recognized topic and talked about in the general media at length. How is that defined?
Premature ejaculation is defined in various ways, but I think the best definition comes from Andrology Australia. That's the Australian Centre for Excellence in Male Sexual and Reproductive Health. Andrology Australia, and they have online as well as in print material a lot of useful resources for dealing with male sexual problems. And in their handout about premature ejaculation, they give a very good definition. Premature ejaculation happens when a man is unable to control the timing of ejaculation and ejaculates before he and or his partner feels ready for this to happen. So it relates not to the actual time that a man takes to ejaculate. That's very variable. But it relates to a loss of control over ejaculation and the distress it can cause to one or both partners. Now, when you talk about how common it is, it's important to recognize that there are two different types of premature ejaculation. It's very common. It can affect men of all ages. But there is primary or lifelong premature ejaculation called PE. And secondary or acquired premature ejaculation. Lifelong premature ejaculation is defined or is accepted to be present when a man has not had control of ejaculation from the time of his first sexual experience. So it will continue for the rest of his life, and that's because pathways. Say the chemical imbalance in the brain centers can result in a lower ejaculatory threshold. So these men need less stimulation before they ejaculate, and it can happen sooner than desired. In fact, some of them may not know that they have premature ejaculation as defined by the media, because they and their partners are happy with that situation. The acquired premature ejaculation is usually when a patient comes in, and that can happen as a result of relationship issues, due to, say, other problems. Generally, it's due to anxiety. One of the reasons that it's come into the media now is that some of us as GPs have learned, probably through experience or word of mouth, that patients who are taking antidepressants like the SSRIs tend to come and report back to you that their ejaculation is now prolonged. And in some situations, antidepressants have been used as a treatment for patients who want their ejaculation to be prolonged. The clever drug companies have discovered that there's a drug called Dapoxetine, and that's being marketed overseas in Scandinavia and some parts of Europe as a treatment for premature ejaculation. It's a derivative of the SSRIs, and it is used and recommended to be used, and there are several studies that have been done, probably funded by the company that manufactures it, showing that it is effective and acceptable. That's just one method of treating premature ejaculation, but there are several other methods which are discussed in the article.
Thank you for that. Low libido is also a very distressing problem that less commonly presents. Perhaps you'd like to run us through the key points in assessing and managing that problem.
The important thing when a patient comes with low libido is to be aware that it's commonly due to, shall we say, non-organic causes. And things like fatigue, if a patient is under stress, if the relationship is not doing well, if they're having depression or anxiety or psychological well-being is not what it should be, they can have a lack of libido. And it's difficult to define because libido can change with aging, it can change with the partner you have. And so it's difficult to actually define, but patients do come and say, "Doctor, I don't have the same desire for sex as I used to." In that situation, it is important to make sure that the patient is not having some organic cause for the loss of libido. Things like endocrine disorders like diabetes and thyroid disorders, sometimes the very medications that we prescribe for patients, beta blockers, for example, antidepressants, antipsychotics, sometimes the drugs that the patient prescribes for themselves, like alcohol, all these can cause a loss of libido. So if a patient comes with the complaint of a loss of libido, that's the sort of patient that you need to spend a long time on the consultation with, asking the questions to make sure that this is not something organic or something iatrogenic, and then, if necessary, either deal with it yourself with psychotherapy or refer the patient on to a psychologist or a relationship counselor to help them with the dealing with the problem.
Thank you for that. For complete, we should say a few words about testicular lumps and prostate disease. Perhaps just a few key points to summarize what you think are the important issues here.
Okay, with regard to testicular cancer, I remember when I was a medical student, the textbook that we had for surgery listed the symptoms of testicular cancer as bone pain. Now, bone pain is fine. But by the time you get bone pain, that patient needs, the disease has spread. The important thing is that we get the message out to the community that any young man who's got a lump in his testes needs to come and see his doctor. The majority of times these lumps are cysts or hydroceles. A few occasions these are testicular cancers, and the only way you can distinguish is to examine, undertake an ultrasound scan, and if a testicular cancer is discovered, treatment in the early stage is excellent. You can get like 95 to 99% cure rates with early testicular cancer. The take-home message there is that a man with a testicular lump should be encouraged to present promptly for medical assessment to make sure that it is not the small possibility of this being a testicular cancer, which, if detected early, is eminently curable. With regard to prostate disease, this is something where there is a bit of controversy. My own personal view is at variance with what's given in the RACGP guidelines, the 8th edition, which has changed from the 7th edition. The current prostate cancer screening guidelines in the Red Book advises GPs not to recommend prostate cancer screening, saying that the risks associated with screening outweigh the benefits. Now, that's from the guidelines. The College of Pathologists has also given its guidelines, and their position is summarized as: blood levels of PSA are currently the best available biomarker for detecting prostate cancer. Men seeking to assess their risk of prostate cancer should be offered a PSA test and a rectal examination from the age of 40 years. And PSA measurements performed in men under 50 years are predictive of future risk rather than being a measure to detect a small number of cases in under 50 people. But those with PSA levels above the age-related median should be tested annually. Those men with median PSA levels below the median could be tested less frequently. These are two completely different views. And it is relevant here to talk about some of the studies that have been done, which when the guidelines were written, perhaps those who formulated the guidelines were not aware of. The European Randomized Study of Screening for Prostate Cancer, which is a very well-designed randomized control study, clearly demonstrated the benefits of early detection in reducing mortality from prostate cancer. So encouraging men to overcome their embarrassment and discussing the benefits of screening for prostate cancer could certainly be beneficial. What I do in our practice is talk to patients over 50, say the methods of screening are still not perfect. Currently, we do a blood test and a rectal examination. In the years to come, we'll probably have a more accurate blood test. There are several blood tests being talked about now. But until we have a better blood test, this is something worth doing. What we are doing in testing, I won't use the word screening, is getting a short list of patients who would benefit from having a biopsy of the prostate done, because a lot of the prostate cancers that are detected are not the innocuous leave it alone and the patient will die of heart disease before the cancer kills him. You know, that sort of cancer. They are the Gleason stage 6, 7, and 8 cancers, which can kill a patient. So what I've said here is, or rather what we have said in this article, is that patients can be educated to think about prostate cancer and come and ask their GPs for testing, and I would be very loath, medico-legally speaking, to tell a patient who comes and asks for a prostate cancer test to say you don't need the test. I'll explain the pros and cons, explain the pitfalls and the limitations, and do the test. That is the message that we'd like to give about prostate cancer testing in this article.
Thank you. It certainly is a controversial area. Different colleges have different guideline statements. It appears that strong lines of communication between the doctor and the patient are really quite essential for effective diagnosis and management of these problems that tend to present in an awkward or embarrassing way and perhaps late. Perhaps you'd like to sum up the key points on this.
The key points which you've listed are that, I think firstly we said for successful outcomes, both patient and doctor must be comfortable with each other and we're talking about the problem. And I think that's the key benefit that we have as general practitioners, because there's this famous saying that in general practice, diseases come and go and patients stay, whereas in hospital practice, patients come and go and the diseases stay. We, in many cases, know our patients. And so it's easier for us to broach topics that might be construed as embarrassing with our patients. This is a routine question. I ask this from all patients over 50. Have you had this problem? And it's easier for a patient also to disclose these things, to talk about these things, if they have a good relationship with the doctor. So ultimately it boils down to us having rapport with our patients, the ability to talk to them without using jargon, talk to them in a comfortable manner, and put them at ease so that they can discuss their problems with us, and put them at ease so that we can talk about potential problems with them. I think that's the key take-home message.
Perhaps we'll leave it there. That's the end of today's podcast. Many thanks to Professor Vijay Sinha for his very thorough, informative, and interesting discussion. For more information on this topic, please refer to his full article titled The Male Reproductive System, An Overview of Common Problems, which can be found in the Australian Family Physician May 2013 edition.